Hello, I'm FNH, and this is the Cthulhu Podcast. This podcast, home on the web, is at cthulhupodcast.co.uk. Welcome to this, the 29th of the Cthulhu Podcasts. In today's episode, we'll hear a little about the 1929 stock market crash, and then we'll have a musical number from Billy Murray. And then finally we'll move on to the main feature, where we continue Maureen O'Brien's reading of The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath. Let's get started. Three phases that you'll be familiar with. Black Thursday, Black Monday, and Black Tuesday. These are all used to describe the collapse of the stock market in 1929. All three are appropriate, because the crash was not a one-day affair. The initial crash occurred on Black Thursday, October the 24th, but it was the catastrophic downturn of the Black Monday and Tuesday the following week that precipitated the widespread panic and the onset of the unprecedented and long-lasting consequences for the United States. At the time of the crash, New York City had grown to be a major metropolis, and its Wall Street district was one of the world's leading financial centres. It's claimed, with some justification, that the New York Stock Exchange was the largest stock market in the entire world. The Roaring Twenties, which was a precursor to the crash, was a time of prosperity and excess in the city, and despite warnings against speculation, many believed that the market could sustain high price levels. Shortly before the crash, Irving Fisher famously proclaimed, "Stock prices have reached what looks like a permanently high plateau." The euphoria and financial gains of the great bull market were shattered on Black Thursday, when share prices on the New York Stock Exchange collapsed. Stock prices fell on that day, and they continued to fall at an unprecedented rate for a full month. At 1 p.m. on Friday, October 25th, several leading Wall Street bankers met to find a solution to the panic and chaos on the trading floor. The meeting included Thomas W. Lamont, acting head of Morgan Bank, Albert Wiggin, head of the Chase National Bank, and Charles E. Mitchell, president of the National City Bank. They chose Richard Whitney, vice president of the exchange, to act on their behalf. With the banker's financial resources behind him, Whitney placed a bid to purchase a large block of shares in U.S. Steel at a price well above the current market. As amazed traders watched, Whitney then placed similar bids on the other blue-chip stocks. This tactic was similar to a tactic that had ended the panic of 1907 and succeeded in halting the slide that day. In this case, however, the respite was only temporary. On Monday, October 28th, the first Black Monday, more investors decided to get out of the market, and the slide continued with a record loss. The next day, Black Tuesday, October 29th, about 16 million shares were traded. The volume on stocks traded in October 29th, 1929, was a record that was not broken for nearly 40 years. William C. Durant joined with members of the Rockefeller family and other financial giants to buy large quantities of stocks in order to demonstrate to the public their confidence in the market, but even their efforts failed to stop this slide. The 1929 crash brought the Roaring Twenties to a juddering halt, and the huge investment market that had been building and building for years was simply gone overnight. Despite a minor couple of recoveries, the market continued to slide, and the United States and the world slid into the depression of the 1930s. Well, that was quite depressing. So, on a lighter note, here's a 1924 track from Billy Murray called Dumb Dora.
Bum-bum-ba, I just came over from Spain. La, la, kitty-bum-bum-ba, was there I nearly went insane. I tried to jolly a little hot tamale, but I didn't get very far. This chili con carne was wise to the blarney I filled with my Spanish guitar. Oh, dumb Dora, my dumb Dora, she's the only baloney for me. I play a tango upon my guitar with her castanet, she would tra-la-la-la-la as we frolic through the garlic. I would breathe sweet telegrams of love. She had a way of kissing none could resist. When she kissed, believe me, you would say kiss. She was my sweet dum-dum-dora, and I was her toreador. Dum-dum, deedle-dum-dum-dum, gee, but this bimbo was dumb. Dum-dum, deedle-dum-dum-dum, she was much dumber than they come. Once at a bullfight, she flirted with a champ. With jealousy, I tore my hair. And in that arena, I boiled like Farina and murmured to her in despair. Oh, dum-dora, my dum-dora, she's the only baloney for me. I hired a gondola, invited her in, but she wouldn't go, cause she said she couldn't swim. She believed in auto-suggestion. She suggested I buy a Rolls Royce. She met all our sailors on their visit to Spain. She's praying for war so they'll come back again. She was my sweet dum-dum-dora, and I was her corn on the cob. Pizzicato, staccato, tomato means I love you so in Spanish. Together, oh sweet la grita, I would croon as beneath the moon we stroll. Si senora, recora, capura, how could I keep my self-control? I had heavenly dreams till I found out it means she wanted to borrow my roll. Oh, dum-dora, my dum-dora, you're the only baloney for me. I bought her a motorboat and she hugged me tight. I'll take a battleship if I call again some night. She was my sweet dum-dum-dora, and I was her pain in the neck.
And so to today's main feature. Maureen O'Brien continues her reading of
The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath by H.P. Lovecraft, Part 5. It was now night in that redoubtable wood of monstrous trees, but because of the phosphorescence, one might travel as well as by day. Wherefore Carter set out upon the well-known route toward Celephias, in Uthnargai, beyond the Tanarian hills. And as he went, he thought of the zebra he had left tethered to an ash-tree on Ngranik in faraway Oriab so many eons ago, and wondered if any lava-gatherers had fed and released it. And he wondered, too, if he would ever return to Baharna and pay for the zebra that was slain by night in those ancient ruins by Yath's shore, and if the old tavern-keeper would remember him. Such were the thoughts that came to him in the air of the regained upper dreamland. But presently his progress was halted by a sound from a very large hollow tree. He had avoided the great circle of stones, since he did not care to speak with Zugs just now. But it appeared from the singular fluttering in that huge tree that important councils were in session elsewhere. Upon drawing nearer, he made out the accents of a tense and heated discussion, and before long became conscious of matters which he viewed with the greatest concern. For a war on the cats was under debate in that sovereign assembly of Zugs. It all came from the loss of the party which had sneaked after Carter to Ulthar, and which the cats had justly punished for unsuitable intentions. The matter had long rankled, and now, or at least within a month, the marshaled Zugs were about to strike the whole feline tribe in a series of surprise attacks, taking individual cats or groups of cats unawares, and giving not even the myriad cats of Ulthar a proper chance to drill and mobilize. This was the plan of the Zugs, and Carter saw that he must foil it before leaving upon his mighty quest. Very quietly, therefore, did Randolph Carter steal to the edge of the wood and send the cry of the cat over the starlit fields. And a great grimalkin in a nearby cottage took up the burden and relayed it across leagues of rolling meadow to warriors large and small. Black, gray, tiger, white, yellow, and mixed. And it echoed through near and beyond the sky, even into Ulthar. And Ulthar's numerous cats called in chorus and fell into a line of march. It was fortunate that the moon was not up, so that all the cats were on earth. Swiftly and silently leaping, they sprang from every hearth and housetop and poured in a great furry sea across the plains to the edge of the wood. Carter was there to greet them, and the sight of shapely, wholesome cats was indeed good for his eyes after the things he had seen and walked with in the abyss. He was glad to see his venerable friend and one-time rescuer at the head of Ulthar's detachment, a collar of rank around his sleek neck, and whiskers bristling at a martial angle. Better still, as a sub-lieutenant in that army, was a brisk young fellow who proved to be none other than the very little kitten at the inn to whom Carter had given a saucer of rich cream on that long-vanished morning in Ulthar. He was a strapping and promising cat now, and purred as he shook hands with his friend. His grandfather said he was doing very well in the army, and that he might well expect a captaincy after one more campaign. Carter now outlined the peril of the cat tribe, and was rewarded by deep-throated purrs of gratitude from all sides. Consulting with the generals, he prepared a plan of instant action, which involved marching at once upon the Zug Council and other known strongholds of the Zugs, forestalling their surprise attacks, and forcing them to terms before the mobilization of their army of invasion. Thereupon, without a moment's loss, that great ocean of cats flooded the enchanted wood and surged around the council tree and the great stone circle. Flutterings rose to panic pitch as the enemy saw the newcomers, and there was very little resistance among the furtive and curious brown Zugs. They saw that they were beaten in advance, and turned from thoughts of vengeance to thoughts of present self-preservation. Half the cats now seated themselves in a circular formation with the captured Zugs in the center, leaving open a lane down which were marched the additional captives rounded up by the other cats in other parts of the wood. Terms were discussed at length, Carter acting as interpreter, and it was decided that the Zugs might remain a free tribe, on condition of rendering to the cats a large tribute of grouse, quail, and pheasants from the less fabulous parts of the forest. 12 young Zugs of noble families were taken as hostages to be kept in the Temple of Cats at Ulthar, and the victors made it plain that any disappearances of cats on the borders of the Zug domain would be followed by consequences highly disastrous to Zugs. These matters disposed of, the assembled cats broke ranks and permitted the Zugs to slink off one by one to their respective homes, which they hastened to do with many a sullen backward glance. The old cat general now offered Carter an escort through the forest to whatever border he wished to reach, deeming it likely that the Zugs would harbor dire resentment against him for the frustration of their warlike enterprise. This offer he welcomed with gratitude, not only for the safety it afforded, but because he liked the graceful companionship of cats. So in the midst of a pleasant and playful regiment, relaxed after the successful performance of its duty, Randolph Carter walked with dignity through that enchanted and phosphorescent wood of Titan trees, talking of his quest with the old general and his grandson, whilst others of the band indulged in fantastic gambols, or chased fallen leaves that the wind drove among the fungi of that primeval floor. And the old cat said that he had heard much of unknown Kadath in the cold waste, but did not know where it was. As for the marvelous Sunset City, he had not even heard of that, but would gladly relay to Carter anything he might later learn. He gave the seeker some passwords of great value among the cats of Dreamland, and commended him especially to the old chief of the cats in Celephias, whither he was bound. That old cat, already slightly known to Carter, was a dignified Maltese, and would prove highly influential in any transaction. It was dawn when they came to the proper edge of the wood, and Carter bade his friends a reluctant farewell. The young sub-lieutenant he had met as a small kitten would have followed him, had not the old general forbidden it. But that austere patriarch insisted that the path of duty lay with the tribe and the army. So Carter set out alone over the golden fields that stretched mysterious beside a willow-fringed river, and the cats went back into the wood. Well did the traveller know those garden lands that lie betwixt the wood of the Serenarian Sea, and blithely did he follow the singing river Ukianos that marked his course. The sun rose higher over gentle slopes of grove and lawn, and heightened the colours of the thousand flowers that starred each knoll and dingle. A blessed haze lies upon all this region, wherein is held a little more of the sunlight than other places hold, and a little more of the summer's humming music of birds and bees, so that men walk through it as through a fairy place, and feel greater joy and wonder than they ever afterward remember. By noon, Carter reached the jasper terraces of Kiran, which slope down to the river's edge, and bear that temple of loveliness wherein the king of Ilekvad comes from his far realm on the twilight sea once a year in a golden palanquin to pray to the god of Ukianos, who sang to him in youth when he dwelt in a cottage by its banks. All of jasper is that temple, and covering an acre of ground with its walls and courts, its seven pinnacled towers, and its inner shrine, where the river enters through hidden channels, and the god sings softly in the night. Many times the moon hears strange music as it shines on those courts and terraces and pinnacles. But whether that music be the song of the god, or the chant of the cryptical priests, none but the king of Ilekvad may say, for only he had entered the temple or seen the priests. Now, in the drowsiness of day, that carven and delicate fane was silent, and Carter heard only the murmur of the great stream, and the hum of the birds and bees, as he walked onward under the enchanted sun. All that afternoon the pilgrim wandered on through perfumed meadows, and in the lee of gentle riverward hills, bearing peaceful thatched cottages and the shrines of amiable gods carven from jasper or chrysoberyl. Sometimes he walked close to the bank of Ukianos and whispered to the sprightly and iridescent fish of that crystal stream, and at other times he paused amidst the whispering rushes and gazed at the great dark wood on the farther side, whose trees came down clear to the water's edge. In former dreams he had seen quaint lumbering buopaths come shyly out of that wood to drink, but now he could not glimpse any. Once in a while he paused to watch a carnivorous fish catch a fishing bird, which it lured to the water by showing its tempting scales in the sun, and grasped by the beak with its enormous mouth as the winged hunter sought to dart down upon it. Toward evening he mounted a low grassy rise and saw before him, flaming in the sunset, the thousand gilded spires of Thrawn. Lofty beyond belief are the alabaster walls of that incredible city, sloping inward toward the top, and wrought in one solid piece, by what means no man knows, for they are more ancient than memory. Yet lofty as they are, with their 100 gates and 200 turrets, the clustered towers within, all white beneath their golden spires, are loftier still, so that men on the plain around see them soaring into the sky, sometimes shining clear, sometimes caught at the top in tangles of cloud and mist, and sometimes clouded lower down, with their utmost pinnacles blazing free above the vapors. And where Thrawn's gates open on the river are great wharves of marble, with ornate galleons of fragrant cedar and calamander, riding gently at anchor, and strange bearded sailors sitting on casks and bales with the hieroglyphs of far places. Landward, beyond the walls, lies the farm country, where small white cottages dream between little hills, and narrow roads with many stone bridges wind gracefully among streams and gardens. Down through this verdant land Carter walked at evening, and saw twilight float up from the river to the marvelous golden spires of Thrawn. And just at the hour of dusk he came to the southern gate, and was stopped by a red-robed sentry, till he had told three dreams beyond belief, and proved himself a dreamer worthy to walk up Thrawn's steep, mysterious streets, and linger in the bazaars where the wares of the ornate galleons were sold. Then, into that incredible city he walked, through a wall so thick that the gate was a tunnel, and thereafter, amidst curved and undulant ways winding deep and narrow between the heavenward towers. Lights shone through grated and balconied windows, and the sound of lutes and pipes stole timid from inner courts where marble fountains bubbled. Carter knew his way, and edged down through darker streets to the river, where, at an old sea tavern, he found the captains and seamen he had known in myriad other dreams. There he bought his passage to Cephalus on a great green galleon, and there he stopped for the night, after speaking gravely to the venerable cat of that inn, who blinked dozing before an enormous hearth, and dreamed of old wars and forgotten gods. End of Part 5 of The Dream Quest of Unknown Kadath.
Thanks, Maureen. So that's it for today, except to suggest that if you haven't checked out the Cat and Cthulhu podcast, you might want to Google for that. Until next time.
CthulhuPodcast.co.uk